This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This is Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from What I Came to Tell You by Tommy Hayes. Toward the end of the tour, when his father had taken Grover's class down to the kitchen, to the wood stove, where Julia Wolfe had made meals for her boarders, he told them something Grover had never heard before. His father said Wolfe had been hated by some of the people of Asheville for the way he depicted them in Look Homeward, Angel, but when it became a bestseller, some of the townspeople he hadn't written about were upset for not being included. Wolfe couldn't win for losing, his father said, looking more animated than Grover had seen him in a long time. It occurred to Grover that the Wolfe house was probably as important to his father as the bamboo forest was to him. At the end of the tour, Grover's class ended up back in the main room of the house, where Little Bit and her staff served cider and cookies. Grover had never seen the house so packed. Crowds made him lonely. Grover went off by himself and read the exhibits, taking his time and paying attention to Wolfe's life in a way he never had before. Emma Lee would have approved. Just a few days after the fire, he and Sudi had come home from school to find a U-Haul driven by Leela's long-haired brother and the Roundtree's old van driven by Leela pulling out of their driveway. After they were out of sight, Grover couldn't stand to do anything but go over to the bamboo forest, clear away what was left of the snow from the tapestry, and work alone until the sunset. And having forgotten his flashlights, he worked on into the dark like a blind man, weaving things together by nothing but feel. Chapter 17. Up into the Mountains. The tires squealed around the sharp curves as their father whipped the car back and forth up Highway 19. With every mile they drove, the road grew windier and the mountainsides inched closer. Grover was sure he could roll down his window and touch the striations in the rock. The road opened up to empty fields and pastures with cows that stood on hills in a way that made them look like two legs were shorter than the others. It was Saturday morning, and their father had announced that they were going to get a Christmas tree. Sudi and Grover had assumed, with their mother no longer alive, that they'd buy their tree at the Asheville Farmers Market. They'd been surprised that they'd stopped to pick up Jesse just to drive over to the farmers market. They'd been even more surprised when their father aimed the car north, up Interstate 26, toward Mitchell County. Grover and Sudi had been excited when they realized where their father was taking them. But the farther they drove, the quieter everyone had gotten, until at one point Grover looked over and saw Sudi wasn't smiling anymore. Up front, their father and Jesse had stopped talking. Maybe this trip wasn't such a good idea. They had left I-26 and now drove down into a brown rolling valley and passed through a collection of drugstores, fast food places, convenience stores, and grocery stores that made up the edge of Burnsville. They left all that behind and headed east toward Spruce Pine. Grover noticed orderly rows of miniature green triangles that seemed to march over the wintry brown mountainsides. "They call the Fraser fir the Cadillac of Christmas trees," Jesse said, looking up at the mountainsides. "Christmas tree farming is back-breaking work in the summers, trimming, keeping the weeds down, and doing all that while making sure you don't step on a snake. Do the snakes ever get up into the trees? Grover asked. They're mostly hibernating in the ground by the time they cut the trees, but one warm winter there was an article in the Asheville Citizen Times about a family finding a copperhead curled up among the presents on Christmas morning. Sudie just stared out the window. Grover pressed his hand against the window. It was always colder up here. There. Sudie slapped the window, pointing at a hand-painted sign. Gudger's Christmas Trees, 2 miles ahead on the left. You pick, we cut. They pulled into the long drive that led up to a little brick ranch house above a steep hillside of Christmas trees. When they reached the top and got out of the car, they were met by a young man, maybe 20 years old, who sat on a four-wheeler. "Where's Mr. Gudger?" their father asked. "Pap-Pap died in August," the young man said, then spit off to the side. "Had a good life. Most people had no idea the man was 92 years old. 92, their father said. Grover remembered how Mr. Gudger scrambled around the hillsides, cutting trees or climbing onto cars, tying trees. "When you find one," the young man said, "give a holler." There was a quiet friendliness in the way he talked that reminded Grover of Mr. Gudger. As the four of them walked down into the fir trees, Sudie frowned and said in a shaky voice, "That's sad about Mr. Gudger." They heard a chainsaw start up on the other side of the hill. "Mr. Gudger had a good life," Sudie said, the frown fading. She said it like enough was enough, and she'd decided not to feel sad about Mr. Gudger. The four of them walked down the hillside, wandering off between the trees. After a while, Grover heard Sudie call, "This is it." He found her standing in front of a tremendous bushy tree. "Lord have mercy," Jesse said, coming up to them. "Y'all can't be serious," their father said. He walked around the tree. "I'm not even sure that'll fit in the house." Sudie took Grover's arm. "We like it." Their father looked at Jesse. "Can you talk some sense into these two? Y'all do have high ceilings, and if need be, I can trim the bottom with my chainsaw." "Thank you, Daddy," Sudie said, hugging their father. "Thanks a lot," their father said to Jesse. "We better check it for copperheads, though," Sudie said. "Too cold of a winter for 'em," Jesse said. The tree was so big it covered up the four-wheeler. From where Grover and Sudie stood, it looked like the tree was rolling up the hill under its own power. The grandson spent another half hour tying the tree to their car. "You don't want this baby rolling off on the highway." While Mr. Gudger's grandson secured it to the car, Mrs. Gudger invited them into her kitchen for hot chocolate and homemade cookies. She had them sit at her table while she served them. Grover worried she'd say something about their mother not being there, but even after all these years of them coming here, it didn't seem she remembered them exactly. While they sipped their hot chocolate, Jesse started telling a story about working at a Christmas tree farm and coming across a moonshine still. Their father went over to Mrs. Gudger, who stood at the stove, and told her he was sorry to hear about her husband. "Married 67 years, she said, stirring a pot of hot chocolate. "Losing Henry took the fun out of it." Then she lowered her voice. "But you're a young fellow and need to get right back on that horse." "Ma'am," their father said, "I read about your wife in the paper last spring," the old woman said. "I'm real sorry." Then she said, "But those kids need a mama." Their father looked shaken when he came back to the table, but Sudie was caught up in Jesse's story. The moonshiner gave me 2 quarts of moonshine to keep quiet, Jesse said. Did you drink it? Sudie asked. Jesse looked at their father, me, and your parents. I've never had such a headache, their father said. I was sick for 2 days, Jesse said. It didn't faze Caroline, their father added. She sure could hold her liquor, Jesse said. When they left, Mrs. Gudger came from behind the stove and gave Grover and Sudie big hugs, and Grover knew she'd remembered them down to their very core. You come back next year, she said. I plan to be around a while longer. Figure I'd let Henry fend for himself up in paradise. Man can't even scramble an egg. He'll appreciate me all over again when I do finally show. Aren't we headed the wrong way? Sudie asked. They turned east toward Spruce Pine rather than west back toward Asheville. I thought we'd have lunch at that little diner, their father said. Their father drove slow. Even on its side, the tree added 4 feet of height to the car. Jesse said it was a good thing it wasn't a windy day, or it'd blow the car right over. A long line of cars and trucks had bunched up behind them, stretching as far back as they could see. On the edge of Spruce Pine, they passed a turnoff, and a sign said Spruce Pine Hospital. Isn't that where Leela used to work? Their father asked Jesse. Their father kept his eye on the hospital as they passed. Grover wondered if Leela being up here had played a part in him deciding to come up here to get a tree. Maybe this trip hadn't been as much for Sudie and him as he'd thought. They passed the one grocery store in town, crossing over an old stone bridge that looked to Grover like something druids might have built. That's the Tow River, Jesse said as they crossed the bridge. Named after an Indian princess who drowned. They say she was fleeing her angry father. Why was her father so mad? Sudie asked. She had a boyfriend he wasn't all that crazy about, Jesse said. Their father drove them around downtown Spruce Pine. A couple of blocks of old rock-faced buildings. Baker's Motel and Restaurant. A motel with a blinking vacancy sign. Spruce Pine had 2 main streets, and because it was situated on the side of a mountain, one street, the one that ran beside the railroad tracks, was a lot lower than the other. The street signs said Spruce Street and Locust Street, but Jesse said people called them Upper Street and Lower Street. They passed a few clothing shops, a rock and gem shop, a drugstore, a music store, and a Hallmark card store. It wasn't downtown Asheville, but even so, there were a good many people walking around. Several of them stopped and watched when they drove by. Seems the sequoia we have strapped to our roof is attracting some attention, their father said. At the Upper Street Cafe, they all ordered BLTs and iced tea, except Jesse got coffee. Every time the waitress, a girl Grover guessed to be in high school, opened her mouth, she sounded like Emma Lee. "Can I bring you anything else?" she'd ask when they were done. She put the check beside their father's plate, and as she turned, she winked at Grover. He was still blushing when they got out to the car. "That's some tree," a boy said, who was standing outside a women's clothing store, holding the leash of a black furry dog. "My mama's in there shopping." The boy sounded exactly like Clay. Everybody up here sounded like a round tree. Sudie bent down and petted the dog. "The vet says he's part chow and part anybody's guess," the boy said. "Do you know Clay Roundtree?" Sudie asked. "Me and Clay were in the same grade at Bakersville Elementary till he moved. Good soccer player. They just moved back. Reckon he'll be starting back to school. They live up on the Rhone with Mrs. Sparks." Back in the car, Their father began to veer back over the stone bridge that led to the highway, but the light turned red. Grover looked at his father, staring up at the traffic light. "Wonder how the round trees are doing," Grover said, looking out his window. "Me too," Sudie said. "Bakersville isn't far," Jesse said, "and the Rhone is just beyond it." "If y'all want to visit them that bad," their father said, trying to sound casual, "we have a little time." The light turned green, and instead of going over the bridge, he turned right onto a road with a sign that said Highway 226, and another sign that said Bakersville, 9 miles. Bakersville was smaller and lonelier than Spruce Pine. "There's one problem," their father said as they passed an old building Jesse said used to be the courthouse. "We don't know where they live." "They live on Rhone Mountain," Sudie said. "The Rhone is a very big mountain," Jesse said. "Clay said they live exactly 8 miles from his school," Sudie said. "Where's Bakersville Elementary?" Grover asked. Their father drove a little bit farther through town. "There," Sudie pointed to a low brick building on the side of a hill. His father pushed the odometer. They drove through Bakersville and started up Rhone Mountain. Neat cabins and well-kept trailers were set back from the road. The higher they drove, the fewer houses they saw, and the more they passed through dark sections of evergreen trees, spruce and fir and hemlock, shading patches of snow. Grover couldn't help thinking that if he lived up here, there'd be no shortage of limbs to weave. In the shadowed sides of the mountain, icicles clung to the rocks. As the road steepened, the car's engine whined. Also, the wind picked up, and the Christmas tree shifted on the roof. "Maybe this wasn't such a great idea," their father said. He pulled off to the side of the road, and Jesse got out, tugging on the twine and checking the knots. "That boy must have been an Eagle Scout," Jesse said, getting back in the car. "I don't think I've ever seen such sturdy knots." The car climbed on up the mountain, the engine whining louder. "Clay said Rhone Mountain is the second highest mountain east of the Mississippi," Sudie said. "The vegetation is similar to Canada's," Jesse said, looking at the plants and trees along the roadside. Just as the odometer read 8 miles, a dirt road appeared. "Turn down there," Sudie said. "You sure?" their father asked. They bumped along the dirt road for about a quarter of a mile, their father's eyes going to the roof of the car. Finally, they pulled in front of a small cabin with smoke curling out of its chimney. The cabin sat on the edge of a big meadow with wisp of clouds and a few stunted pine and spruce trees that looked like the bonsai trees Grover had seen on a class trip to the North Carolina Arboretum. "This is it," Sudie said. "How do you know?" their father asked. "I don't see their van," Grover said. All they saw was a green, rusted Subaru parked in a shed around the side of the house. This cabin looked too small to hold Leela and Emily and Clay, too. "We better turn around," their father said. "Some old boy might shoot us for trespassing." His father had started backing out when a golden retriever and a black lab tore around from the back of the house, barking fiercely and circling the car. "No, wait," Sudie said. "Those are their grandmother's dogs, Clay told me about. Benjamin and Midnight." Sudie started to get out. "Hold on," their father said. "Those dogs look like they mean business." Before he could stop her, Sudie was out of the car and calling to the dogs. "Sudie," their father said, jumping out of the car. The dogs came up, wagging their whole hind ends. Sudie bent down, petting them. They licked her face. "They're sweethearts," Sudie said, as Grover and Jesse got out, too. As Grover petted the dogs, He realized how much colder it was up here. The air was lighter up here, and richer somehow. Occasionally, there'd be a break in the clouds. They could see that the cabin was perched on the side of the mountain. They could see valleys and waves of mountains in the distance. "Leave those folks alone." A woman stood in the cabin doorway, talking to the dogs. She was dark and tall and had long black hair like Emily, except hers was pulled back in braids. She wore a flannel shirt, blue jeans, and hiking boots. Grover didn't remember Emily mentioning an aunt. "Mrs. Sparks," their father said. "Yes," she said. "This was Emily's grandmother?" Whenever Emily or Clay had talked about their fierce mountain grandma, Grover had pictured some toothless hag who walked around with a shotgun over her shoulder and a wad of tobacco bulging in her cheek. This woman was the youngest, prettiest grandmother Grover had ever met. She could have been Leela's older sister. "We're the Johnstons," their father said. "You live across from my daughter," she said, walking down to them. "And I'm Jesse," he said, stepping up and shaking her hand. "I know," Mrs. Sparks said. "I'm sorry for descending on you like this," their father said. "We just happened to be up this way." "Just happened to be in the middle of nowhere?" Mrs. Sparks didn't smile. She did smile when she saw the tree tied on their car. The tree covered up the whole roof of the car. Some limbs had come loose and hung down the sides. A Christmas tree on wheels. "We went to Mr. Goger's tree farm," Sudie said. "It's where we always go." "Henry Goger passed this summer," Mrs. Sparks said, "but Irene'll keep the farm running. That grandson of hers is a hard worker." It hadn't occurred to Grover that the Gogers might actually know the round trees. She turned to Grover. "You're the boy who saved my granddaughter's life." Grover looked at the ground. "I just happened to be there." "Just happened to pull my granddaughter from a burning house. Just happened to drive a good 15 miles out of the way. You Johnstons are big on just happening." Mrs. Sparks looked at their father. "Leela and them have gone over to Elizabethton to visit a sick cousin. Not sure when they'll be back." "Elizabethton?" Grover asked. "That's in Tennessee," Jesse said. "We're only a mile from the Tennessee border," Mrs. Sparks said. "Roan straddles both states." Grover felt his heart sink, and from the look on their father's face, Grover guessed his heart had sunk too. "Come in and have some tea." "No, thanks," their father said, "but please tell them we came by." "You went nearly an hour out of your way," she said. "The least you can do is let me give you some tea." "We better get on down the mountain," their father said. "No telling how long it might take us with that tree." He sounded defeated. "They'll be sorry they missed you," Mrs. Sparks said. They started back to the car. "Could I see your weavings?" Grover asked Mrs. Sparks, who was halfway up her walk. "Why, sure," she said. "Maybe another time," their father said to Grover. "When?" Grover asked. "When will we ever be up here again?" "Maybe this spring," their father said. "We'll never come back here," Grover said, "and you know it." Grover was surprised at his anger. "I'd like to see her weavings, too," Sudie said. "Me too," Jesse said. Their father sighed. "We should only stay a few minutes." The front room was toasty from the wood stove that roared in one corner. "I'll put the kettle on," Mrs. Sparks said. "Don't bother," their father said. "It's no bother," she said, disappearing into the kitchen. Bookshelves sagging with books crowded the walls. Emily had said her grandmother drove the county bookmobile. Woven mountain scenes occupied wall space that wasn't taken up by bookshelves, like the weavings Grover had seen in the Round Tree's house. Mountain scenes, sheep grazing in a meadow, a man holding the reins of a mule plowing his field, a dark-haired girl, who looked a lot like Emily, milking a cow, two boys, one who looked like Clay, fishing in a stream. Woven scenes hung everywhere. They looked like paintings from a distance, but the closer you got to them, the more you saw the individual strands. Their father was more interested in her books. "She's got a first edition of Look Homeward, Angel, and another one of You Can't Go Home Again." "You run the Wolf House," said Mrs. Sparks, coming in from the kitchen. "He's the executive director," Sudie said. A gust of wind whistled down the chimney, making a fluttering noise in the stove. "Where's this one?" Jessie pointed to a weaving of a little cemetery overlooking a long view of the valley below and the mountains beyond. "I can take you to see it after we have tea." "Do we have time?" Jessie glanced toward their father. "Sure." Their father didn't look up from what he said was a rare biography of Wolfe. The house seemed bigger inside, but even so, it would be cramped for four people. There was this front room, and then, as far as Grover could tell, there were three small bedrooms and the kitchen in the back. One bedroom had bunk beds. He saw a couple of soccer balls and piles of books. Clay and Emily must have shared this room. There was a bedroom that must have been Leela's, and another that must have been Mrs. Sparks. Next to this cabin, Jessie's rental house was a mansion. "Emily tells me you're quite the artist," Mrs. Sparks said. "I just mess around," Grover said. "Emily says she's never seen anything like your tapestries," she said. "You and I both know she doesn't say anything she doesn't mean." Mrs. Sparks sat him at the big loom that was halfway done with what looked like a scene of a garden. She showed him how to slide the shuttlecock through and how to push on the pedal that pushed the yarn into place. It made a satisfying clicking sound. "How do you know what the scene is?" he asked. "Do you draw it first?" "I've been doing it so long, I work from the pictures in my head." After they drank their mugs of hot tea, Mrs. Sparks took them, with the dogs running ahead, along a worn path that led into woods, a dim, dripping forest of evergreens. With its ferns and moss, much of it encased in ice, and with its little animal paths running all through it, the place reminded Grover of enchanted woods where gnomes or hobbits might live. The forest held little clouds that they passed through. Sometimes they even lost sight of each other. After a few minutes, they came into a large open area, and on the far side, between clouds floating by, they saw the cemetery, the wet headstones gleaming. Grover remembered Clay saying that he'd looked after it. They walked among the headstones. They came to one, whiter than the others. "That's their daddy," Mrs. Sparks said, coming up beside Grover. "He was a good father and a good husband," she paused, "before the war." She showed them older headstones that included her husband's, Emily's grandfather. "I'll be buried here, too, one day. You can't beat the view." When they got back to the cabin, their father said they should leave. "They'll be so sorry they missed you," Mrs. Sparks said. "We wish they'd move back," Sudie said. "Sudie," their father said. Mrs. Sparks put her arm around Sudie. "I like a girl who speaks her mind." Then she said, "To tell you the truth, I wish they'd move back, too. Don't get me wrong, I love them to death, but we're in the middle of nowhere up here." She looked at their father and Jessie. "The kids feel isolated. They both like Claxton. They love living in Asheville. Honestly, I was starting to enjoy having my house back. I'd lived alone for 15 years before they moved in, and I've never gotten used to having so much family underfoot." Tell them to move back, Sudie said. I tried, she said, but their mama was shook up by Emily nearly dying in that fire. She thinks it was a message from God. And you don't? Jesse asked. I think she's afraid, Mrs. Sparks said. Afraid of God? Sudie asked. Afraid of being happy again, she said, not looking at their father. There was an awkward moment when nobody said anything. We better get going, their father said. One second, she said. Grover, come with me. He looked at his father, who motioned him to follow her. Jesse and I will be checking the Christmas tree, his father said. Mrs. Sparks led him back into the front room and disappeared into the kitchen. In a minute, she came out with a long cylindrical package wrapped in brown paper and tied with twine. A small token for just happening to crawl on your hands and knees into a burning house and just happening to carry my sweet Emily to safety. Thank you, he said, making sure to look her in the eye. Your mama must have been one remarkable woman to have such a boy as you. Her eyes seemed to glisten. He was halfway down the path when she called to him from the door. Grover? Yes, ma'am? The world needs our art, whether it knows it or not. He ran to the car and climbed in. As they pulled away, they waved at Mrs. Sparks standing in the doorway. The dogs chased their car down the dirt road. As their father started down the mountain, Grover looked at the wrapped package, turning it over and over. "Well, don't just sit there," Sudie said. "Open the thing." Grover carefully untied the twine, one of her weavings. He unrolled it across the back seat and into Sudie's lap. The weaving that Jesse had pointed out of the cemetery and the mountains beyond. "Oh, Grover," Sudie said, gently stroking the fabric, "she gave you the best one." When they got home, Jesse cut off a few inches of the tree with his chainsaw so it would stand in their living room. He helped them get it up in the stand, then said he had to go home and check on Tippy. Their father put on the lights, like he always had, with Sudie checking the strands for any bulbs that needed replacing. When their father brought down the big box of ornaments from the attic, Sudie's face darkened and her eyes got all shiny. Grover knew what she was thinking. Their mother had always been in charge of putting on the ornaments. Sudie was reaching to hang a gingerbread man ornament on a limb when her shoulders slumped and her face crumbled. Their father was busy replacing a bulb. Grover nudged him. Sweetheart, their father sat Sudie beside him on the couch. It's not the same, Daddy, Sudie said, rubbing her red eyes with the heels of her hands. It's just not the same. I know, their father said. Grover agreed with Sudie. It wasn't the same. Hadn't been the same since that April afternoon. If only they'd somehow known what was coming, they might have paid closer attention to the time they had left with their mother. We don't have to decorate it now, their father said, if y'all would rather wait. Don't be ridiculous, Sudie said, sniffling. It was something their mother would have said. Grover and his father exchanged glances as they watched Sudie push herself up off the couch and carefully hang the gingerbread man on the tree. She dug around in the box of ornaments until she pulled out a long, small box. She opened it and slowly unwrapped the paper until she arrived at a clear glass teardrop. Grover and Sudie had gone in together and bought it from an artist at the Grove Arcade for their mother Christmas before last. She'd said it was her favorite ornament. Sudie started to hang it on the tree, but then paused, and her lip trembled. "Here," she said, taking Grover's hand and placing the teardrop gently in it. "Hang it somewhere high," she said, looking at him with clear eyes, where everybody can see it. Chapter 18. It wasn't Jesus. Ever since the woman had stabbed the for sale sign into the bamboo forest, Grover had thrown himself into his weavings in a way he'd never done. He spent every spare moment in the bamboo forest, weaving harder and faster. Whenever he wasn't in school, he was in the bamboo forest, cutting, tying, and weaving. When he was at school, he filled notebook after notebook with sketches. He hung the weaving Mrs. Sparks gave him on his bedroom wall, and at night fell asleep looking at it, touching it. He dreamed of leaves and limbs weaving themselves. He'd wake wide-eyed late in the night, pull on his clothes and his coat, tiptoe through the house, and sneak out to the bamboo forest, where he'd work for an hour or two, then slip back into the house before anyone knew. Grover wasn't sure what had come over him. Maybe it had to do with the round trees moving. Maybe it had to do with this being the first Christmas without their mother. Maybe it had to do with knowing that the bamboo forest wouldn't be around much longer. Or maybe it had to do with keeping sadness at the edges. He didn't know, and he didn't have time to figure it out. The ideas for tapestries came so fast that he could hardly keep up with them. His tapestries had gotten so big they needed more support. Instead of tying them in place, he began weaving his limbs between the living bamboo shoots. It kept the big weavings from toppling over and caving in on themselves. He did this more and more, weaving in his collected limbs between the standing bamboo. He liked the look and the feel of the more brittle-cut limbs woven between the flexible living shoots. Up was living, across was dead. He couldn't move these tapestries since they were rooted in the ground, so when he finished one, he'd simply leave it and move on to the next. He cut a spiral hallway into the bamboo forest, like photographs he'd seen of the Guggenheim Museum in New York, and wove tapestries all along the hallway. Sudie kept him supplied with limbs. All he had to do was reach into the pile she was always stocking and choose the perfect limb. On the weekend, when he wove all day, she brought him lunch. On those nights their father stayed late at the Wolf House, she carried his supper out to him while he worked by flashlights. Their father had become so busy with the Thomas Wolfe Christmas that Grover and Sudie hardly saw him. For a little while, their father had said that a Thomas Wolfe Christmas was an overwhelming success, but lately he'd just been saying that it was overwhelming. He stopped making breakfast for them. Often he was cranky, like he'd been in the old days when the Wolf House was empty of visitors. Judging from his father's behavior, Grover guessed that success and failure had a lot in common. Their father was too preoccupied to notice Grover's grades had slipped. Grover had been working so hard in the bamboo forest that when he was at school, he could hardly keep his eyes open. Often he'd lay his head on his desk, and the next thing he knew, Mrs. Caswell would be calling his name, and he'd jerk his head up. At recess, he'd fall asleep working his Rubik's Cube. Sam or Mira would wake him when the bell sounded. One day, Miss Snyder woke him and asked him to come back to her office. "Mrs. Caswell will wonder where I am," he said, sitting in a chair in her office. "She's the one who asked me to talk to you," Miss Snyder said. "She says you've been falling asleep in class." "I've been a little tired lately," he said, trying to stifle a yawn. "Your schoolwork has suffered. Is something going on at home?" "No," Grover said. "You answered that mighty fast. Our father has been busy at the Wolf House." He hoped this would be enough to satisfy her counselor's curiosity. "Are you sure there's nothing else?" "Nothing." Grover didn't want to tell her about the streak of tapestries he was working on. As exhausted as he'd been lately, he felt more like himself. When he was hard at work in the bamboo forest, he became connected to something solid and true, something he could count on, something that would not go away. One afternoon, Grover had been putting the finishing touches on the last weaving, his biggest yet. He was tired, but happy. He'd finished a whole hallway of tapestries. He'd woven in the very last pine limb of the last tapestry and was standing back studying it when Sudi came running through the bamboo. "That lady," she said out of breath, "she's back." Grover and Sudi crept to the edge of the bamboo forest and watched the woman haul 5 for sale signs out of her trunk and stab each into the ground. They waited till she'd driven off before they walked over to the signs. Grover had never seen a realtor put out more than one sign. Every driver who passed would notice, and sooner or later someone would buy it. "I hate those signs," Sudi said. "Remember what Daddy said," Grover said. "I know, I know," Sudi said. "If we pull them up, we might get him in trouble." A cold wind blew, and the signs made a little singing noise. "There are so many of them," Grover said. "Maybe we could pull up just one," Sudi said. "I don't know," Grover said. "I have a funny feeling about this." He looked up and down the street, but he didn't see a soul. "It's too quiet." Sudi ran up to one of the signs and was straining to pull it up. As she slid it out of the ground, a man streaked from around the far side of the bamboo forest. Sudi dropped the sign and ran back up the path that led to the studio. The man followed her, and Grover ran up behind him. Sudi had reached the studio when the man grabbed her coat. Grover shoved the man hard, and when he did, the man lost his grip on Sudi's coat. But then he whirled around and grabbed Grover's arm tightly. "Now I've caught you." Grover recognized the voice before he recognized the face. He tried pulling away, but Lunsford's grip was strong. "Grover!" Sudi had stopped when she saw Mr. Lunsford had hold of him. "Go get Jesse," Grover said, "and take Biscuit with you." Sudi scooped up the dog and ran hard through the bamboo. "What is this all back here?" Holding Grover's arm, Lunsford looked around at the tapestries and the lean-to and the piles of limbs. He glanced at a couple of Grover's tapestries. "Hard to believe your father would come to me hat in hand just so you could make these silly things. This is child's play." Grover tried to pull away. "Speaking of your daddy," Mr. Lunsford said, "let's see if he's home yet." He walked Grover out of the bamboo forest and headed up the street. "He's not home," Grover said, seeing his father's car wasn't in the driveway. "We'll wait," Mr. Lunsford said, keeping a grip on Grover's arm. He seemed to be taking in the overgrown grass and the uncut bushes. "Son, you ought to spend your time doing something helpful for your daddy, like yard work, instead of messing around in that bamboo." Their father's car turned in the driveway. Grover's heart sank. He would be furious that Lunsford had caught them pulling up signs. Their father had barely stopped when he was out of the car, marching toward them, looking as angry as that night he'd torn up Grover's studio. "I caught your boy pulling up my signs," Mr. Lunsford said. "How dare you," his father growled. "I'm sorry, Daddy," Grover started. "How dare you lay a hand on my son," their father said. "Let go of him." but I caught him red-handed, pulling up my signs," Mr. Lunsford said, sounding a little less sure of himself. "Let go." Their father stepped up to Mr. Lunsford. Mr. Lunsford frowned at their father for a minute, then let go of Grover's arm. "Him and that little daughter of yours were pulling up my for sale signs." "Sudie didn't have anything to do with it, Daddy," Grover said. "Honest to God," said Mr. Lunsford, "what is all that mess your boy's making back in there in the bamboo? If what he's doing back there is art, then I'm Pablo..." His father grabbed Mr. Lunsford by the collar. "Don't ever talk about my kids. They're good kids. My boy is a fine artist, and anybody who says otherwise answers to me." Jesse came trotting up. "Let him go, Walt." His jaw working, their father stared at Mr. Lunsford, like he was making up his mind. Then he let him go. Mr. Lunsford hurried down the driveway, looking behind him and tugging on his collar. When he was at the bottom of the driveway and a safe distance, he said, "You've done it now, Johnston. You've gone and done it now." They watched Mr. Lunsford hurry up the street. They saw him pick up the one for sale sign and stab it angrily into the ground next to the others. He climbed into his shiny new Audi and drove back to the bottom of the driveway, rolling his window down. "I'll be having that canebrake leveled," he yelled. "It's an eyesore. Come to think of it, that's probably why the property isn't selling." They watched him drive off. Grover still couldn't believe their father had grabbed Mr. Lunsford like that. "I'm sorry if I got you into trouble," Grover said. "I was the one who pulled up the sign," Sudie said. Their father looked at Jesse. "Any openings for an assistant landscaper?" "I think you're jumping the gun," Jesse said. "Lunsford has been waiting years for an excuse to get rid of me." "He won't cut down the bamboo forest," Sudie said. "Will he?" Their father glanced at his watch. "I need to get back. We have 5 busloads of church ladies coming in." He looked up at Grover and Sudie. "Will y'all be okay a little while longer this evening?" "They can come to my place and do their homework," Jesse said, "and I'll feed them too. So stay as late as you need." He nodded at Jesse, "and thanks for calling me." So that's why their father had shown up out of the blue. "I'll try not to be too late," their father said, starting to get into his car. He looked at Grover. "Don't go over to the bamboo forest again this evening." "But," Grover began. "I said don't go over there," his father snapped. Then in a quieter voice he said, "At least not anymore today. It is his property." Their father backed out of the drive. "I left my toolbox," Grover said to Jesse. "I'll go with you," Jesse said, as they watched their father drive away. Jesse and Grover and Sudie walked back to the bamboo forest, pausing on the street to make sure no one was around. Jesse shook his head at the line of for sale signs. "Let's do this quick. We don't want Lunsford catching us." "Will he get Daddy fired?" Sudie asked. "Your father has a lot of friends in this town," Jesse said. Grover couldn't get over what his father had just done. Not only had he stood up for him and Sudie, he'd defended his weavings. Grover had gone across his studio to pick up his toolbox when he saw Jesse standing in front of a couple of the big tapestries. They were as tall as Jesse. "Lord have mercy," he said. "These are incredible. You did these?" "Sudie helped," he said. "You haven't seen anything," Sudie said, motioning toward the hallway. "Sudie," Grover said. They hadn't shown anyone the hallway. "It's Jesse," Sudie said, holding her hands out. "We have to show Jesse." Grover didn't know why he felt shy about showing these new weavings. He'd worked on them so hard and thought they were his best yet. Maybe that's why he felt shy about showing them. Maybe they were terrible. Sudi moved aside a little gate Grover had made to hide the entrance. She led Jesse down the hallway, showing him the dozen tapestries Grover had woven. Tapestries on both sides glimmered and pulsed with colors. Jesse didn't say a word. Grover picked up his toolbox and followed them. He'd been so busy making the tapestries that he hadn't had the time to see them. He didn't particularly like looking at things he'd finished. He always saw mistakes, something he could have done better. He'd figured out that what mattered wasn't the thing made, what mattered was the making. The hallway came out on the side closest to Grover's house. "Has your father seen these?" Jesse asked. "No," Grover said. "People need to see them," Jesse said. "You heard Mr. Lunsford," Grover said. "He's having the bamboo cut down." "We can move them to your yard," Jesse said, "and set up an exhibit." "They can't be moved," Sudi said. "We weaved them into the bamboo," Grover said. A car passed by. "We better get out of here," Jesse said. They walked out of the cane, passing the for sale signs lined up along the road's edge. As they walked up the street, Grover looked over at the rental house. The workmen had left for the day. Not a single light shined from inside. Before the round trees had moved in, Grover had hardly noticed that house. Renters had come and gone. Since the round trees had moved out, he'd catch himself looking for Clay kicking the soccer ball against the house, or Emma Lee reading on the front steps, or Leela pulling into the drive after a long day at the hospital. Sudi and Grover walked up to the rental with Jesse to see what the workmen had done today, but as they cut across the yard, Sudi picked up something out of the grass, right by the front steps. "Look," she said, holding it out to Grover as Jesse went on inside. As Grover took it, he realized it was a pair of mangled and muddy black-framed glasses. They must have been there a good while and been trampled on more than a few times. As he turned them over, he had a flash of Matthew with new wire-rim glasses. That night, Grover went out to the kitchen and found his father at the table, drinking a glass of milk and eating a plateful of Oreos while reading the paper. He looked up from the paper and held out the plate of cookies, but Grover shook his head. "Turning down Oreos? Are you ill?" He smiled a tired smile. Grover set the mangled glasses on the kitchen table in front of his father, who picked them up and put his finger through the hole where a lens was missing. "I'd say these have seen better days." "Sudi found them off the porch of the rental house," Grover said. "Really? Maybe one of the workmen's?" "I'm pretty sure they're Matthew's," Grover said. "Really?" His father bit into another cookie, then took a drink of milk. "Matthew, you know, Jesse's assistant. I think he must have been the person who helped me get Emma Lee out of the house that night." His father nodded. "You don't seem surprised," Grover said. "I'd already guessed," he said. "I was fairly sure he'd been watching over you and Sudi." "Watching over us?" "Ever since that night I wrecked your workshop, and the next morning found the weaving hanging back up, and the toolbox back where it had been, I had a suspicion." "Why would he do that?" His father sighed and looked up at him. "Matthew was the driver." "The driver?" "Of the car that hit your mother." The force of this news shoved Grover down in a chair and sent his heart racing. Strange as it might seem, he'd never given much thought about who'd been driving the car. The image that had camped out in his mind was of his mother following Biscuit out into the road. He heard the screech of brakes, and there it always stopped, the moment frozen, car and driver just out of the frame. Matthew was devastated, his father said. It wasn't his fault, Grover said, feeling almost numb. Everybody said it wasn't the driver's fault. Even so, I imagine that's not something you get over easily. Why didn't you tell me? You and Sudie had been through enough without having to bring it all back up, he said. Jesse asked me if I minded if he hired him. I thought it might help him. I told him that was fine, as long as Matthew didn't bother y'all or try to talk to you. I figured he'd be finished up with school and gone soon enough. But you said he's been watching over us, Grover said. That's my guess, he said. Why didn't you do anything? It's creepy. What was there to do? I couldn't prove anything. Besides, I knew he was basically a good guy, a little on the strange side, but a good guy, and I thought it might help his recovery. His recovery, Grover said, feeling a surge of anger. It was our mother he hit. And she would have been worried about him, his father said. Grover thought back to the mysterious straightenings of his workshop and of his mother's grave. He remembered the day he and Sudie had fought with the guy who wanted the realtor's phone number off the sign. How his car began to mysteriously roll away. He remembered the firm hand on his shoulder, guiding him through the smoke, helping him carry Emily to safety. Who knew what all Matthew had done for them in the past couple of months? Yet gratitude wasn't among the feelings that trailed him back to his room. He lay in bed, unable to sleep, and looked out at the rustling bamboo. In the back of his mind, he had believed that his mother's spirit had been watching over them, and that at least some of these happenings might have been her doing. How foolish he'd been! He felt cheated, tricked, and in a way, as if he'd lost his mother all over again. Chapter 19. Grover's Waltz. Dead, dead, dead is what I am, thought Grover as he walked to the Wolf House. His father had called Claxton and asked that he come straight to his office after school without Sudie. For the rest of the school day, Grover had wondered why his father wanted him to come alone. The only explanation could have been that he'd found out about Grover's slipping grades. But if he was in trouble, part of him didn't care. Ever since he'd learned about who was behind the mysterious happenings in the bamboo forest, nothing seemed to matter as much. His father met Grover at the door of the Wolf House, put his arm on his shoulder, looked him in the eyes, and said, "It's time." He started walking Grover along downtown streets. After they'd walked a couple of blocks, Grover finally screwed up enough courage to ask where they were going. To buy you a coat. A coat? For the Christmas waltz. He was surprised his father had remembered the waltz, which was tomorrow. He himself had all but forgotten. Still, every sixth grader had to attend. Although he wasn't a big fan of shopping, shopping for clothes with his father had always been less painful. His father would take him to a store, let him try on a few clothes, and then buy whatever Grover liked. This reading of What I Came to Tell You by Tommy Hayes will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina.